Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. A lot of people are feeling a sense of helplessness and maybe even a little bit of hopelessness. Today we discuss the psychology of demoralization, and with us, social worker Ann Gagan. Good morning, Ann.
Hi, good morning.
Psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz. Good morning. I think he doesn't know has to be on the phone. And then psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Good morning to you, Mark.
Good morning. Hi.
So I guess we should start the conversation with defining what demoralization is.
Sure, I can kick in with that because there was a psychiatrist that really started to put it on the map in the early 1960s, or at least as a concept that people in mental health should pay attention to, and that was a Dr. Jerome Frank from Johns Hopkins. He felt that the sense of demoralization was the was really what drove people into the office of a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a social worker. It's not so much the symptoms themselves that might be troublesome. It's when the symptoms get to the point that they bother the individual so much, they have so much distress that they can't, which they can't control, they can't manage anymore. That they develop this sense of helplessness, hopelessness, and even into a sense of meaninglessness, plus a subjective incompetence. In other words, they feel that they're just not good enough. Say if we're looking at psychiatric patients, they feel that they have a character defect because they might feel depressed or anxious. They feel incompetent about it. Their self-esteem goes down. So all of these kind of feelings are wrapped up in the concept of demoralization. It basically is a kind of like an end state to facing something you can't control that is dominating your life, making your life miserable. I mean, one obvious example is concentration camp victims. They were certainly subject to a sense of demoralization, and we know that demoralization preceded death and in concentration camps. That is when Eli Weisel described this phenomenon, when the inmates in the camps stopped caring about whether they could bargain for cigarettes or not. That gave them some meaning in their lives, you know, playing the game to get cigarettes. But when they gave up on that, they were dead in a few days or a few weeks. They were demoralized. I think this is a timely thing for us to look at now as we face two things that have been demoralizing the whole country, really. One is the COVID situation. We can't control it. We can't fix it. The other is the racial injustice that's now, thankfully, in everybody's face. And again, that's not something that you can control, fix real quickly. The reason I thought of this topic was it was the morning after George Floyd was killed. The talking heads on the TV news shows usually are very perky, even when they have bad news. These people just look completely deflated. You know, what can we, you know, what's next? How bad can our country get after witnessing or watching that videotape and then counting the numbers of deaths and how rampant COVID is and how threatening it is. So I just saw on their faces demoralization in capital letters.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of demoralization going. I think a lot of people are feeling really very helpless at the moment. And that's it's a frustrating feeling because you want to do something, but you don't know what that something is, right?
Right. You don't have a roadmap in your head of how to do. It's not, you don't have a clear path to fix something. That's distressing in and of itself. Is a trigger for deeper feelings of hopelessness, helplessness.
Yeah.
And
anybody
want to
add, Anybody want to add anything to what Mark said?
One of the characteristics also was a sense of feeling trapped. And I think that, again, we have so many things in our culture that up until the point of COVID, we use to keep us, you know, busy, engaged, distracted, indulged. And when we are faced with the idea of, no, you have to stay at home, and you can't see people, and you can't touch people, and you can't, there's all these can'ts, that it comes in on us as feeling trapped, and it comes in on us as being helpless. And it's the idea of that that is making people feel discouraged and in some cases demoralized. The idea of not being able to come up with any solutions. How do I watch my, you know, 49ers or, oh, I'm sorry, it should be the Patriots, excuse me. How do I do these normal things that that make my life, that fill up my life? So I think it's very, I think it's important to, and we will talk about the balance of this, about deep demoralization is persistent and long-term, and the syndrome is created by ongoing helplessness, ongoing inability to affect change. And I want to keep a balance in this in terms of personal integrity and personal ability to affect change, even if it's small change. And I know we'll get back to that.
Yeah. Jonathan, you want to add anything?
Well, I think that, you know, for me, what has been most profound about this has been an awakening, personal awakening to how embedded in our white culture the perpetuation of economic, social, cultural hardship has been imposed upon Black people. I have to say that I've always thought of myself as a, you know, pretty liberal, a non-prejudiced guy, and now I discover, in part through this very powerful documentary, The 13th, which I have recommended to you and which I would recommend to all of our listeners, that's on Netflix, that we've all, and I say we all, meaning the group of us who are here on the radio, our lives have evolved from the time that we were kids in a society that it appears has really been organized to keep Black people and people of color in a terrible position. It's not only about the prison populations, although that's obviously a topic of great, you know, interest, and there's a lot to be said about it. But it's in so many ways, we've all been part of a problem. And speaking for myself, without really realizing it. And it's painful. I mean, I found the documentary difficult to watch. Had to stop watching it a couple of times because it just felt like too much. And yet that's been the life of America essentially since the Civil War. I haven't been alive that long, but for as long as I have been alive, I've certainly been part of a society. And I think that before we can even think about how to fix it, I think there's that initial, for me anyway, that initial stage of kind of realizing what I've been part of that's really kind of painful.
Yeah. And not only have you been part of it, but we've all, that people that are white, have benefited from it in so many ways that we don't question. It's just kind of, you know, white privilege is a real phenomenon. It really is a privilege to have a white skin. So many things flow from it. I don't have to be particularly scared if I'm stopped by a cop. Black people do, especially teenagers. You know, when my daughter got her driver's license, I wasn't afraid of her being stopped by a cop. I wish she would stop by a cop, and as a matter of fact, I wish she would be if she was going too fast or had a light out or something or other. That's not the case for black people. That it's a dangerous thing to be put in handcuffs. I have a theory about why the man in Georgia who lost who had a friendly encounter with the policeman for a number of minutes for a while, but when they put the handcuffs on him, that's when he lost control of himself and got aggressive. I think what was going through his mind, if I can read into it, was they're going to kill me because of what happened to the other, to George Floyd, for instance. I can see his mind going in that direction, and it's understandable. He paid the ultimate price for that.
I think that also that the horrendous murder of George Floyd pierced our cultural trance, the trance that, it was like, it was such a defilement of our values. It hit to the heart of how can we be in this place at this time in 2020? How can this be? And I think that was it pierced and it broke our hearts and woke up people to how did this happen? Yeah. Where are we? We are lost.
Right.
That's what I feel happened.
I think Jonathan brings up a good point about this realization, you know, as you're saying, hadn't thought of yourself as a prejudiced person and watching that film, The 13th, which I haven't gotten to yet, I think a lot of people are coming to this realization, and it's a difficult thing, and these are difficult conversations, I think, but necessary ones. And one of the things, and Mark, some of the information that you kind of shared with us before the show, I found it really interesting. There's this thing, the influence of mindfulness on racial biases, and the very first thing there is the awareness of racial bias, because there are so many white Americans who are completely unaware of what the reality is, right?
Exactly. And if you try to fight it and remain unaware, you're probably going to get demoralized over time, because you can't control it. And you really, at this point in time, I don't think our culture can ignore it anymore. It's simply too real. And too many people are willing to acknowledge that. We could always ask the question, why now? I mean, these cop killings have been going on for a long time. But I think the whole country has been rendered helpless and on its knees from COVID. This happening on top of it stimulated activity, stimulated action, even to the point of people jeopardizing their health by going out and demonstrating. But it stimulated action. In some ways, it was a perfect storm, but I think the historians will look back as it's a favorable coincidence, really, these things happened on top of one another.
You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the psychology of demoralization with social worker Ann Gagan, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. If we're talking about demoralization, there seems to be some similarities with depression. So what is the difference between demoralization and depression?
You want to take it, Mark?
Basically they're next door neighbors or they're cousins, something along those lines, because there's an overlap, obviously. Depression is more of a bodily syndrome, a body syndrome, as well as a mind or thinking or feeling symptom and syndrome. The body just won't move. the motivation is not there to do what the person knows they should be doing to ameliorate their depression, like get up and out of bed and take a shower. They know that'll make them feel better, and but they just pull the covers up over their head. That would be a typical depression. Whereas demoralization is a little bit different angle. You feel distress, you feel despair, but you don't really have a map to do something. Whereas in depression, you might have a map, you just can't get the body to on the road. In demoralization, you just don't have an idea of how to go about it. Even though it might appear logically, for instance, if you're an alcoholic, get yourself to AA. That would be logical, but alcoholism, for instance, is demoralizing, I think when people talk about hitting their bottom, I think that what they're talking about is a state of demoralization, not necessarily depression. They're related, certainly, but there is a difference, and demoralization can, when it happens, serve as a trigger to get you going, because it's awfully disturbing, really, to feel it, to be in that state.
Jonathan?
And a big factor is the helplessness and the hopelessness, the sense of no meaning. There's no meaning to my life. There's no purpose to my life. Why am I bothering? Nothing I do is going to affect anything. Why bother? And, you know, this is a very big issue for folks dealing with advanced cancer, end-of-life issues, because those are the questions, those existential questions seem to come up when the prognosis is poor, when the treatments are failing. The individual oftentimes is thought to be depressed, but they're really demoralized, and the difference being that they are dependent, they have no future, they can't imagine what they're going to do, how they're going to, it leads oftentimes to suicidal ideation and the idea, what's the point? There's no point in my life anymore. Yeah. So, and, you know, it's a different kind of end-of-life attitude versus someone who's lived a good life and they say, well, I'm ready to go. I'm calm. The demoralized person will say, get me out of here. There's no point. Why bother? It's an agitated, impatient frame of mind, and it needs to be addressed. And lots of times hospice really goes to the heart of those that existential demoralization and angst at the end of life. So there are some interventions that can help.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, did you want to add anything?
Well, I was going to say that to me, demoralization is a kind of a supreme form of functional frustration where you feel that no matter what you do, it's not going to make a difference. I use the term a lot when I'm talking with patients who have ADHD that's untreated. People who have ADD, untreated ADD, often find themselves they're trying to do what they feel they should do, they can do. They're being told by everybody around them that they should be able to perform, to do well, and yet they keep stumbling and getting into trouble and not finishing things they started and so on. And it's a very demoralizing but not depressing condition of, as I say, sort of supreme functional frustration. It's not really, well, it's certainly not something that's treated with antidepressants per se, because you've got to really alter the structure of what's going on for the person's life. And I suspect that describes what we've created in a racist society where, black people, people of color, people of minority groups find that despite their efforts, they're not hired for jobs, they're not given opportunities, they're not given this everything that all of the white people who are on the screen right now are routinely given.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk right. to Kristen, who's giving us a call from Orleans. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning. Thank you so much for addressing this topic.
You bet.
I have a few thoughts, but just quickly, there's, the aspect of also post-traumatic stress from just constant throughout their lives, that sort of demoralization and devaluation and marginalization that they experience on a regular basis. And one of the real eye-openers for me was attending a white privilege conference where I learned things I had never known about the history of racism and about the history of the Black experience in America. And after going to that conference, one of the things that came up was that people who are born into interracial families, some people can actually pass as white, whereas their siblings cannot. And people are actually, it's a differentiation based on skin color that is astonishing. And studies on that have been really interesting. And as well as the darker your skin is, it sort of like exponentially increases as far as how much you are discriminated against. So it's, it's just, it's all fascinating. And I would just encourage anyone to not be so reactive when approached with the topic of perhaps being racist themselves or recognizing their own internalized racism, because even people of color have internalized racism. Yeah. So, I'm just so thankful that you're talking about this.
No. Oh. Kristen, thank you. And I just want to mention here that tomorrow we are going to talk with some activists of color, both young and old, and ask the question, does this feel different? A lot of people are saying this time feels different. But then there are others who said we've been down this road before. We have seen, horrible, there's been a lot of past experiences that people said, oh, this is it, and it wasn't it. So we'll talk a little about that tomorrow. But Kristen, thank you for the phone call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So as Kristen was saying, it's a difficult reality, and it's a difficult thing for us to do, but these are the conversations we have to start having. Go ahead,
that's
Mark.
Right. Yeah, she did mention something that actually is fascinating and bears some examination, really. And that is that Black people are prejudiced, too, against people that have the darker skin. I think they've internalized the powerlessness that's been foisted upon them since they set foot on these shores, the blacker the person, somehow they're worse. At least it seems that way, it's a cancer that our preoccupation with skin color. It doesn't make sense because we're all humans, mm-hmm. but it's as if there's a subset of humanity that is not quite human. That's the way our society has been built, economically, certainly. It's been built that way. And that was the reason for Blacks coming to these shores anyway, was for to give the South labor so mm-hmm. that they could produce their crops. There's this built-in power differential that we just accept without examination, and I think hopefully now we'll start examining it.
Anne, you look like you want to say something. No.
Okay. I think we're covering a lot of territory here from that the idea of a demoralized individual to the idea of a demoralized group of people and conditions that keep people demoralized. And then the other piece of this, there's a remarkable article that I read called The Demoralized Mind that really talks about our culturally generated demoralization, that we live in a society and a culture that places consumption and material goods and the whole idea that there's never enough, I have to have more, the addictive qualities that can keep a whole culture demoralized because there's never enough, I'm never satisfied. And youth, I think very many kids don't have any sense of cultural meaning, their place in culture, their place in society, and therefore they get into the trance of the technology and more technology and more technology. And that's where I get all my identities from, this technology. So I think there's also another whole larger sphere of demoralization that we have been facing in our culture that has made us feel helpless and hopeless. Like how can our values and the things that we believe in not be reinforced and not be made priorities? I'm going to make a political comment here. It's like, okay, let's open up and get back to business at the same time that the COVID is increasing in and I know people need contact, but the value of the economy pitched against the value of human life, that's something that we got to look at.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And that's cultural.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is a political thing that we're dealing with. And don't forget the push from the top, from the White House at least, is to get the economy going. But the reason he wants the economy going is so that he can bask in some glory and claim and help his reelection. If his reelection were to be helped by a poor economy, he would want that. That's another. I think he has set the tone and fed into a sense of demoralization throughout the country, that we don't have somebody in that place that we can look up to as a leader, as a moral leader, because he just doesn't have those capacities.
Yeah. So certainly we have lots of fertile ground here for demoralization on so many. It seems like we were going down that road, as Anne is saying, with the technology before COVID-19. Then we have COVID-19. We have, the police brutality and all of these things. And it just seems like, Mark, you were saying you watched the news after George Floyd was killed and you could just see the demoralization in the people who are on the television set. And it seems that every day you think it just keeps getting worse and you have these feelings. So let's talk a little bit about what do we do with these feelings? I mean, some people are getting up and they're going out and they're joining these protests, hopefully peaceful protests. So what are your thoughts on, I know some people have said, well, I try not to watch too much news. And we've talked about this in past shows is, don't be 24/7 watching and absorbing all the news, it'll just drive you crazy. So you want to do that in moderation. But what are some of the other things we could be doing?
Get out there, get outside, experience your own feelings. Stop listening to what the media is feeding you, because that's not you in your life. That's not you in your life. That's a general reporting on these issues. Start with yourself. Start feeling, how am I feeling? What can I do? Whether it's participation in a march or it's calling a friend, you have to start with yourself and be aware of the big picture, be aware of the trends, but not have that be your own frame of reference. We've lost our own experience, and that's what demoralization is. We lose our own experience. We lose our own sense of where we fit into all this. We lose our sense of belonging in our community. And take a walk, say hello to a neighbor. I mean, sometimes little tiny steps, active steps, activity is the antidote to demoralization, taking small steps. Hold on to what you believe and feel. Check out your values. Check out your belief system. Take time with that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You're touching on what Mindy talked about earlier in terms of mindfulness, knowing what goes through your mind and being able to observe it and not, prejudge or judge yourself for what you're thinking or feeling, but just observe so that curiosity actually can be a very good antidote to demoralization by observing how you're experiencing what the world is now. Just observing it. You don't have to talk about it. These are the quiet moment kind of daydream content that you can do. And when you are more aware, say some kind of prejudice that you've had, you might actually the next time around hold yourself back, because if we acknowledge that we're all prejudiced to some degree or another, the task for being a moral human is to master that, is to direct it, is to control it and diminish its harm, harmful effects. When we talk about, when you're asking what can we do, the first thing is look at ourselves, like what you're saying, Anne, and also be active in the process. But just observe ourselves so that we can, and be curious about how your mind works, you can be more, the more curious you are, the more open-minded you are, about your reactions, the more options you're going to have to act and be more open to doing some things differently.
I think having conversations with people of different backgrounds and reaching out. I've had the most amazing conversations with my 33-year-old son that I never would have imagined I had since the George Floyd incident. He was very passionate about it. I'll just share that he told me some stories. We moved when he was 9 years old from beautiful Sonoma County, California, to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, where he went into a highly integrated school. And he said, "Mom, I have to admit, the education per se was not what I was used to, but I am thanking you for the cultural experience of being in an integrated school with 50% Black students." And he said that has served me more in my life and has made my passion for this current time and movement so deep, because I'm familiar. These are not the black people are not unfamiliar to me, and I've made friends throughout the course of my life. It's not an issue. It's not the other. These are my friends. Mm-hmm. So I called friends that lived in Louisville and tried to get a sense of what it was like for them. Reaching out to people that are on the front lines in their own communities, if you have friends, talking to people and bringing the subject up, either demoralization or per se, or what's going on in our country, instigating those conversations. We can do that. That's an action.
Yeah. Sure.
You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the psychology of demoralization with social worker Ann Gagan, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're talking about some of the things that we can do, and it's this kind of this going from passive to active to some kind of action. And you sort of touched on this, but we're also talking about the importance of meaning, right? It's so overwhelming, and we're saying, well, what can we do? And whatever little thing I'm going to do doesn't make a difference. But if everybody had that little thing they did, it would make a huge difference. So sure. I guess going back to that, just the meaning, if you feel like, what's the point? How do you find meaning again, I guess, is the question.
Well, I asked it in therapy. That's a real important question to ask. And people struggle with it because in many cases, they've never asked that question in their lives. And now, and amazingly, with the COVID, and being in a quieter, slower, more intense time, those questions do arise. Like, what have I been doing? I've been a workaholic. I've been, you know, running hither and yither, and then when I get home, I put on the TV, and then I watch TV or get on the internet, and it just because it. I think there's an opportunity to re-examine and reset. I think, I'm that silver lining person, that I think this is an incredible time if we're willing to slow down and say, ask that question of ourselves, what motivates me? Why am I, what gives my soul solace? What do I love? What do I love?
Right.
And that's a word that I've been hearing in these demonstrations, love. We haven't heard that in a while. What gives me satisfaction? And again, we have a society that just like, okay, if you go on that cruise, you're going to be the happiest person in the world. And then you get off the cruise and go, well, that was nice, but maybe the next cruise will give me that, or the next thing, or the next thing. It's a very dissatisfied culture we live in because of consumerism, our young people would say, and I say, but also to examine, to just take time to examine, gosh, that was a satisfying conversation. Why? Gosh, when I went out to do, give that Meals on Wheels meal to those folks, and that beautiful soul smiled at me and waved, it was satisfying. We have to relearn what satisfies us really, and pay attention to that and move towards that.
Exactly. You know, you remind me of the Mr. Rogers movie.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I think he was a psychotherapist without the license or the training maybe, but he had a question that he would ask people, tell me, who was it that loved you into being?
Yeah.
If you just examine those words, who loved you into being? That's how we are. I mean, that's how we get to be, is by being loved and loving back. You can just imagine when you take an inner look at that, you really kind of open up your mind to experiences, feelings that you've had that go to the very core of yourself and the very core of how you look at the world, you know, the very core of what forms some of the basis for your biases in the world. And of course, we've all had our own individual experiences as to who and how we were loved into being. What you were saying, Anne, just reminded me of that and how important and central it is. And I think it makes sense to incorporate that in psychotherapy. Who loved you into being? So
yeah. We could use more Fred Rogers in this world.
Yeah, that's right.
Exactly.
You know, I wonder to what degree the upcoming presidential election will actually, for many people, become almost a comparison of two different future approaches to fundamental attitudes. It's easy to see how those who choose to, you know, vote for the incumbent are people who are really deniers of this fundamental structural racial issue, and those who choose to vote for the Democrat will be those who are saying, God damn it, it is time for us to fundamentally change the way the correction system operates, the way the prison systems operate, the way police forces operate, the way opportunities are made available to anybody and everybody, regardless of, you know, skin color. And it wouldn't surprise me if it, for many people, became just that sort of issue.
Yeah, I was going to say, and a lot of people, you know, as we start talking and the political season starts heating up, I have some people saying, oh, it's so depressing. I just don't even want to face it. And that kind of leads to the question of, with a lot of us feeling demoralized, does that demoralization, that can turn to depression, right? That can become depression, right?
Mm-hmm. It certainly can, and it did become that for me after the last election. But I also think that for many people, now there may be a lot of people who are galvanized into action to work personally, actively on behalf of the candidates that, you know, that they are rooting for. Mm-hmm. Because we were talking earlier about how the antidote to demoralization is action.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
Yeah. Big and small steps. And again, I think the idea that the possibility of a reset takes us back to the, you know, the Black Lives Matter have signs that say 1619. It takes us back to the arrival of the first slave into our country. And if we can reset that narrative, and that's the narrative, and we have to start telling a much broader story about the founding of our country and the way in which all people were brought in and treated, then I think we can I think that will push us towards a reset in our economic system, a reset in our spiritual system, and a reset certainly in the way in which we treat the environment. Mm-hmm. It seems to start there. That's just my intuition. It seems if we start there and reset the entire narrative, we can make fundamental change, and it's meaningful. Mm-hmm. And we kind of, like, I think most of us know this, but we've gotten very distracted.
Sure.
And the distractions have been boring and disheartening.
They certainly have. Just to echo what you just said and what Jonathan was saying about the choice of the election, it's really a choice between reinforcing authority and power versus, if you want to put it in a squishy kind of way, loving one another, having regard for one another, having empathy for one another. That's, I think, the stark choice. At least on the national level, as to what we have to choose. And this goes, it's not just the presidential, it's the Senate, the House, you know, it's the governors, whatever. It's what kind of person you want to make some decisions for you. Do you want them guided by the love and the need for power and control? Or do you want them more geared toward caring and empathy? That's why, you know, someday we're going to have a female president, and females are more biologically oriented that way. It is something that we all yearn for, and that's okay. That, you know, we don't have to be hyper masculine or something and deny that that yearning, that need. But I think the people that steer themselves or find themselves steered more toward loving authority and rules and rigid classifications More money is better, that which is more power. Hopefully we're going to start to diminish that influence of in our lives coming up. So the election's a big piece of activity.
All right, let's talk to Steve, who's giving us a call from South Dennis. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Right. Thanks for doing this topic. It's very hard, but we got to get it out there. And I'd like to mention one fantastic book. It's called White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. It's why it is so hard to talk to white people about racism.
Right.
So if you get a chance to read that.
It's on my reading list, Steve. Thanks for suggesting it. Yeah, this book has gotten a lot of play, and the author has been doing a lot of interviews. And yes, thanks for suggesting that. That's a great idea.
Okay.
Appreciate your call.
Great.
Yeah, thanks.
Sure.
And Steve brings a good point, and I think we've sort of said this, is this: it's a time to reexamine what our own biases might be and educate ourselves, right? And you know, this is, I think the book he's talking about, I haven't read it yet, might start some conversations that, again, are difficult but necessary. If we really, you know, want to see change, we have to, you know, all be in this, right? It isn't, it's interesting in conversations I've had with some people of color. It's like, this we can't change this. It's white people who have to change this, right? And that, it's true.
Yep. Yeah, that's what the attorney for the family in Georgia said. We're asking for a mental change in white people. And that's what that's our challenge, to change our mental biases and automatic reactions that have been they've been fostered through culture. They've been systematized through our economic structure. We need to change. Once we change the mental part, then the organizational parts will follow.
Yeah.
I just had a thought that I think, I don't know whether this is interesting, but that the COVID and the idea that we're restricted in our movement, restricted in our interactions, restricted in our futures, that's a parallel process to me, to what the African-American experience has been.
Mm. Yeah, we all know it now, to some degree.
We feel it viscerally. I believe that there is something visceral that we now get on a different level, what it's like to have no future that we can see, losing our jobs that we can see, not being able to be with our families. These are all patterns of institutional racism that our black brothers and sisters have been dealing with since 1619.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
we're going to have to leave it there. But I do want to mention again, tomorrow we're going to continue the conversation with that question of, is this the moment? Is it different? And what we'll hear from some activists who've been putting together some of these marches. And so we hope you'll tune in tomorrow for that. Social worker Ann Gagan, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and psychiatrist Mark Whaley, thank you for being here and sharing the conversation with us this morning.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.